Hello, my name is Hugo Prévost, and welcome to Entretien Journalistique, a podcast about media and journalism. Today, my guest is Tom Shanker. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Hugo. It's great to be here with you.
Mr. Shanker, you are the director of the Project for Media and National Security at the School of Media and Public Affairs of the George Washington University. That's a bit of a mouthful.
Yes, I'm sure a better editor would have made that shorter. So you're exactly right.
What is exactly the Project for Media and National Security?
Sure. We are based at George Washington University, but we are a program that convenes senior national security officials from Pentagon, State Department, White House, Congress, as well as from abroad. We've had several senior officials from other countries, ambassadors, defense ministers. They come and sit with national security correspondents here in Washington. I moderate. And our goal, Hugo, is to fight fake news by allowing great correspondents to sit for an hour with senior officials discussing national security policy so that these officials can explain what they're doing and the reporters can write strong, fact-based, informative stories.
You have also been a Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times for, I think, over a dozen years. Am I right?
Yes, exactly right. So right after 9/11, for the first 12 years of the war on terror, invasion of Afghanistan, Iraq, and the sad aftermath of both of those.
And you've been embedded in the army in Iraq and Afghanistan. You've also been the Tribune's Moscow correspondent in the late 80s and early 90s. So that's quite a... That's quite a history there. That's quite a career.
That's a polite way you go of saying that I'm an old guy. You're exactly
no,
right.
No, that's no, but that's quite interesting because obviously today we're talking about the war in Ukraine. Mm. We've just passed the 2-year anniversary of that. The current invasion. We could talk about the fact that it started a few years before, but let's call it the proper, in quotes here, proper invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And we're here to talk about, obviously, about war journalism and how to report on a conflict. I want to first of all, ask you, how does one decide to cover a war? Did you wake up one morning and told yourself, oh, I want to go underground and I want to go in Iraq and Afghanistan?
You know, maybe some reporters chase the sound of guns. I was not one of those. I came to it from a deep interest in foreign policy and national security, and so was assigned places that sadly fell into conflict. It's interesting. You mentioned my time in Moscow. I was the Tribune's Moscow bureau chief, and I covered Ukraine's vote for independence in August of 1991, a moment of great hope and promise and excitement. And for sure, we all know the jagged trail to democracy with corruption and all of that, but it was a moment of real hope. And so the invasion 2 years ago was just heartbreaking because Putin's trying to roll that back. And again, I can tell you're a student of history because the first invasion really was in 2014. I have a new book out called Age of Danger, where I talk about Putin as the threat hiding in plain sight. And I'm so glad you mentioned because, 2 years ago was not the first invasion of Ukraine. It was 2014 and Putin took Crimea, yes. large swaths of the country, and the world did not push back. And it was that unsuccessful effort to counter Putin that gave him the courage 2 years ago to do it all over again and go further.
When you go on the ground to talk about an armed conflict, I'm guessing obviously you get some sort of training. Did you go through a special course? Did you do the obstacle course that the soldiers did? Or what did you do exactly?
So the first war I covered was the war in Bosnia in the 1990s, a vile medieval-style war fought with 20th century weapons. And I had almost no combat training in advance whatsoever. But I was there for 2 years. So believe me, Hugo, it was a daily school in how to cover a conflict and try not to get killed or wounded. I was hired by the New York Times. And so before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, really before Iraq, the military did put on a 2-week media boot camp. I'm not sure I really needed it after having spent 2 years covering the war in Bosnia, but I went anyway because if you want to embed with troops, you need to know how the unit moves and maneuvers and how not to get in the way. Some news organizations, as you probably know, do send their correspondents to hostile environment training. These can be 2 weeks longer, taught by retired military folks. Those are all very good because the more you know about conflict, the better off you are. I'm sure you and your listeners watch all those cops movies and war movies where somebody starts shooting and so they crouch behind a car door. Well, you learn car doors do not stop bullets, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really important to understand how to keep yourself safe in a conflict zone as much as possible. And if the shooting starts, hiding behind a car door will not save your life.
Obviously, when you're embedded in an army, there's this question about objectivity and about truth, because as you all know, the first victim of war is truth. Was there any doubt on your part that your coverage would not be 100%? Not to say that you were writing lies, obviously, or fake news, but it's always you report what you get as information, and it's obviously you cannot necessarily go on the front line in the trenches and just be an impartial observer because you're gonna get shot at or killed. So was there any point in the many times you went underground to cover a conflict that you told yourself, well, my work is possibly incomplete?
So it's a great question, and there are two answers, if you'll permit me. The most direct answer is to the question of when you embed with units, do you become so part of that unit that you can't tell the whole story? I assure you that never happened to me, never happened to any of my colleagues. I covered missions that did not go well. I wrote about them accurately, even if painfully. And when it was all over, the unit commanders would always say, well, you told the story right. We did something wrong, and the truth will set us free. And I was never censored. I was never criticized. The professional military understands that war is complex. Things don't always go correctly. They just want you to cover them honestly and accurately. And if they make mistakes, it's been my experience, Hugo, that they never try and punish you or criticize you. The bigger question, though, is about military embeds. That's one reason I was so honored to work for the New York Times, because in Afghanistan and Iraq, we covered the war so thoroughly. We had embedded reporters with the military. We had independent reporters based in Kabul, Baghdad, elsewhere. We had reporters at NATO headquarters, the Pentagon, State Department. So even if the embedded reporter story is a very narrow thread view, with all the other reporters covering other parts of the story, you go, all these threads get woven together into a tapestry that tells the whole story. So I don't think you can cover a war well only through embeds, but if you add all the other pieces of the story, you get a very complete narrative.
When the war started in 2022 in Ukraine, we saw obviously a huge number of journalists from elsewhere in the world went in Ukraine, like you said, from the New York Times, from other media. And we also saw at least, I think, a dozen or even more journalists get wounded or even killed. Is there a price, in your opinion, is the price too heavy to pay sometimes for the truth to get out?
Every loss of a colleague is extremely painful, and people don't really remember, but the war in Bosnia, more correspondents were killed than during the war in Vietnam or even in World War II. So reporters do pay that price, but we feel that it's important to inform the world about these horrific acts. And some of the best war correspondence, I think, is the story of how it affects civilians. And you see these powerful stories coming out of Ukraine today, not just about where is the front line and how many artillery shells were hurled back and forth, but about the teachers teaching kids from the safety of subway platforms or the doctors who are treating troops with brain trauma. So I just think it's really important for us to tell that story and to speak for those who can't speak for themselves.
As someone who once again covered a lot of armed conflicts over the years, what is, in your opinion, the main difference between what we saw in Bosnia and Iraq and Afghanistan and what we're seeing today in Ukraine in terms of reporting?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about it. I can't see any significant differences in the reporting, but what is very, very different, and this might be the heart of your question, Hugo, is the access to information. There was very little social media in Bosnia. There was very little at the start of the Afghan and Iraq campaigns. They, of course, developed it. But in Ukraine today, every citizen with a cell phone is like a reporter. They're capturing images of the bombing, of the death, of the destruction, of the attack. And so there are so many more threads of information available to a reporter from just common, not common, but from the average citizens. And it's both helpful because you can be lots of places at once, but it's also hard to discern what is accurate and significant from what is not.
And well, that was my next question. Because like you said, over on social media, when the war started, we all saw these images from, for example, that armored column going towards Kyiv and getting stuck because logistical reasons and so on. But we can still today go on Telegram, go on Twitter. I am a big user of Reddit, and there's a space on Reddit where you can see combat footage. Unedited, well, it's edited by the people that are producing it, but I mean, you can see tanks getting get blown up or people getting killed by drones, and this is, like you said, it's this sort of a new era in journalism where, like you said, the flood of information has never been that important, at least in a conflict before, and as much as it's fascinating to see, because it's, as I said, it's edited footage, obviously, but it's still raw in a sense that it's not, there's no voiceover, it's not a 2-minute segment on the 6 o'clock news. Is there a risk in your view that someone could just watch this and miss the bigger pictures? There's a problem in terms of, it's not a problem of access, it's a problem of quantity in that sense.
Right. So once again, you ask these very thoughtful questions that require two kinds of answers. So I hope you'll be patient with me here.
Sure.
The first answer is what's good about all of these new sources of information. It used to be that only intelligence services with satellites in the sky and spy planes could tell you when an invasion started, beyond, of course, the people in the first village that was being overrun. But the Russian invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago was first reported publicly. Now, of course, intelligence knew about it, the Russians, of course, Ukrainians, by a professor and his research students at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies in California. They had been watching Google Maps for days, and at 2 a.m., whatever it is, Ukraine time, they saw on Google Maps the traffic patterns that all these border crossings were suddenly clogged. All the trucks, all the cars, the transports weren't getting through, and they just reasoned that's because the tanks have taken over those checkpoints and they're moving forward. So the start of the war was first announced publicly by a little graduate school in California. So the access to information is incredibly helpful. Here's where it's a challenge, though. Also early in the war, you remember there was those Twitter stories about this brave Ukrainian naval outpost that refused to surrender, and they used a very colorful 4-letter word, although in Ukrainian, I think it's a 7-letter word, but that's neither here nor there. And it turned out that just wasn't true, or it was true, but they had not been killed and wiped out, sacrificed. They'd been captured. So I'm not judging the bravery of the Ukrainians, of course not. That's on display every single day. But without verification, some of these Twitter stories are not really trustworthy. The one that really bothered me, Hugo, having spent 5 years in the Soviet Union, was right when the invasion started, there were Twitter photographs of street protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And if you saw those photos of Revolutionary Plaza filled with people or Manej Square filled with people, you would say, oh my gosh, huge popular uprising in Russia to Putin's war. Well, but if you understand, those were just very, 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 very narrow photographs. Maybe mm-hmm. there were a couple thousand people, but that is 0.00001% of the Russian population. And while, as we've seen with Navalny's death, shall we say murder recently, and the people who came out, there are growing street protests. But those early ones, I think, were completely misjudged as being more significant than they were, because the individual photos were impressive, but there was no panoramic view to show mm-hmm. that's not happening anywhere else.
And we are in a situation, I believe, where it's our objectivity as journalists has taken, it's still there, but it's taken some kind of a hit, because it's a situation where it's us versus them. It's the old Warsaw Pact. Well, it's Russia now, but the old Soviet enemy against NATO, against the West. And so it's an authoritarian regime against a democracy, albeit flawed as it is, but still a democracy. So there's a feeling, and I felt it too, as a citizen and also as a journalist, that we don't have to lie, obviously, but we have to morally defend this idea that we're fighting against an invader, an oppressor, and so it's, I believe it can be easy to, not knowingly, of course, but it can be easy to adopt a point of view where, there's, like you said, there are protests in Russia and there are people rising up, and maybe, but it's, like you said, a few thousand people. They are more than 120 million people in Russia. So it's an easy trap to fall into.
No, that's absolutely true. Journalists, when I was covering the war in Bosnia, for example, it was very difficult because one had to carefully discern the differences between horrible acts, even war crimes, committed by aggressors mm-hmm. from those committed equally horrible, but in response to that aggression. And neither one is allowable, but it is okay to make that judgment call. And similarly with Ukraine, look, NATO and the U.S. are hardly perfect. I think you and I would rather live in NATO and the West than in Russia. Yes. That said, if you look at American policy in the Middle East, major strategic errors, I think we can all agree today. That said, when Putin invaded Ukraine, he invaded the territory of a democratically elected government of a state that was independent, with a seat at the UN, and was in no way hostile or aggressive toward Russia. Ukraine was never going to invade Russia. Mm-hmm. NATO was never going to support Ukraine invading Russia. So all of Putin's pretenses for that invasion are false, and he is the aggressor, and we do not lose our right to objectivity and fact-based judgment when we weigh the facts and come to that conclusion. Putin is the aggressor. Ukraine is not a neo-Nazi aggressive state as described by Putin, nor is Ukraine historically part of Russia any more than could Mexico claim New Mexico, Arizona, and California today. You don't get to do that. You don't get to pick a point in time and say, okay, this is where history starts and stops. Ukraine was an independent country 2 years ago, and it should be an independent country today.
We've talked about it before briefly. You were in Moscow at the end of the 80s, guessing the start of the 90s too. Yes. Obviously a time of great change. I won't use the term revolution, but that's still the fall of the Soviet Union. How was your job? Because today we think about Russian journalism as a state where you cannot write or say or tell anything unless you want to end up in a camp somewhere or just get killed. Until recently, I was working also at CBC, and we had to close our Moscow bureau because the Russian state decided that we were foreign agents or something like that. So we had to move out, I think, 30 years after opening, after opening the bureau. You have to close it down because now we were, like I said, foreign agents or dangerous people. So when you were there, how were you afraid to end up in prison? How did it go?
It's such a wonderful question. I got there in 85 and left in late 91, early 92. So I arrived with Gorbachev, left when Gorbachev left office, and there I arrived in the Soviet Union and I departed Russia. So during the end of the Cold War era, Western reporters were actually relatively safe because the myth of the Soviet state was that it was a workers' paradise, no crime, et cetera. So it was in the KGB and militia's interest to make sure we weren't mugged or robbed or anything like that. To be sure, we were harassed. My car was hatcheted, no doubt by the KGB at one point, for all the stories I was writing about dissidents and refuseniks. Reporters were occasionally arrested, as was Nick Danilov of U.S. News. But he was only at Lubyanka, the KGB jail, for 12 days, whereas Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal, our colleague and friend, is about to set to have his first anniversary of being in one of Putin's jails. So huge difference in the severity. And journalists were not assassinated during the Soviet era, as they have been under Putin. There's a new documentary coming out about a heroic Russian journalist, Anna Politkovskaya, who reported about the war in Chechnya. She was poisoned once, a la Navalny, and then she was assassinated in her apartment for her stories. So the time that I was there, it was challenging, it was difficult, but the threat to our personal safety was nothing like it is today for my colleagues, yours, and others who are trying to report honestly about Putin's Russia.
And do you believe that one day we'll get back to at least that kind of status quo where, yes, there can be some problems, but you won't, like you said, end up in a jail or worse?
I think that it's a great question and one that I simply cannot answer because it really depends on the fate of Soviet of Russian politics and Russian leadership. I mean, one cannot see what you just said, Hugo, happening while Vladimir Putin is still president. So if he leaves office eventually on his own, owing to death or to some other cause, we will see what happens. But people I talk to who do live there and are still there, they think that even Putin's successor will not be any kind of kinder or gentler leader.
And maybe one last question before we end this interview. When you see stories from the ground in Ukraine about the war and so on, do you miss that kind of, maybe action or work? Do you, obviously, well, you're a bit older now than you were in early 2000s, but do you think sometimes, oh, I would like to go there and once again live that kind of, I don't want to use the word excited, but that kind of action and adrenaline?
You know, that's a fair question. And students at George Washington University ask me, my colleagues ask me a lot, so it's a fair question. And my very fair answer is absolutely not. What people don't understand is that when you go to cover a war, Hugo, it covers you. And you can never, ever wash it off. I gave myself body, heart, soul, family to three wars, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. I think three wars is enough. And I do not wish to be back. I have deepest respect for my colleagues and friends who are still doing it. But it was time for me to step back from the front lines.
I understand completely. Tom Shanker, Director of the Project for Media and National Security at the George Washington University. Thank you very much for being here today.
Hugo, great conversation. Thank you for hosting me.
And of course, to people who are listening right now, and thank you very much also for being there. We're slowly getting to the 100th episode of the podcast, so that's quite exciting for me and the team at PIEV. So if you want to listen to other episodes of the podcast, we are on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We're obviously on PIEV.ca, and I'll talk to you next time.